Okay, today is April 3rd, 2017, last day of the Zman. We'll conclude Perek Chaf Hei today, and then pick up afterwards with Perek Chaf Vav, continuing on in Parshas Truma. So within, there's three different little nekudos they'd like to discuss. So number one is the issue that is in the beginning of the parsha of collecting the truma. Now there is an interesting sforno that says, Me ish kol ish, asher yiven libo tikul es trumati, from all the people who want, you're going to collect my money. So there is no shul membership, there is no shul dues, there is no building fund. It was whoever wants to come ahead and give the money. Now apparently that was enough. They were able to make all the money. That's what's described, as described in the Torah itself. But there's no requirement that they pay that amount. So why not? Why wasn't there a requirement? So one idea is that there's no idea of forcing a person to give truma. So Shalom, what is your name?
Yoshua Simon.
Yoshua Simon, welcome. Are you related to Rav Baruch Simon? We'll be quoting from him, but I guess that shouldn't mean much to you. All right.
I mean, yes, I am.
Okay. So there is just a whole interesting sugya about what's called kfiya b'tzedakah, because there is a rule in Gemara land, there's a rule that anything that has shematan schar b'tzedan, any mitzvah that has the reward accompanying the mitzvah, we don't force people to do. So there is an idea that we could force people to put on tefillin, we could force people to buy mezuzahs. Sounds good to me. We can force people to do all sorts of mitzvos, but we can't force them to do specifically mitzvos that have a reward attached to them. So I believe that manifests itself by Kivud Av'eim. Kivud Av'eim, or Shiluach HaKeim, but Kivud Av'eim is famous because it says, L'man Yerichun Yamecha Al Dama, you're going to have a long life. So Beis Din is not going to force you to do the mitzvah, because the Torah itself, so to speak, forces you to do the mitzvah in order to get that reward. So an exception to that rule is that the Gemara in Ksuva seems to say that a person who gives tzedakah, that you can force a person to give tzedakah, which is a little bit of an odd thing, because that seems to go against the rule as well, because tzedakah, it says that in order for you to, you'll gain wealth, Hashem will pay you back, you'll get the things in return, so the reward is given, you shouldn't force people to give it, but yet nevertheless the Gemara is clear that you are permitted to force a person to give tzedakah. If anybody wants an article on that, I wrote something on that once upon a time in a Beis Yitzchak, in the YU Torah Journal, and I'd have to look it up to tell you what it was. So we could do that another time. Anyways, but that is not a requirement for the mitzvah of giving towards the Mishkan. So why is that? Why is it that it was not considered a requirement that they would not force people to give money for the purposes of the Mishkan? So the Rav Soloveitchik, in the Rav Thinking Aloud, on the book of the first entry of the Book of Truma, so he suggests the following idea, and that is, before to answer this question, you first have to ask another question, and that is, what is the purpose of a Mishkan? Why did we build the Mishkan? And why did we build the Beis HaMikdash? So if I were to ask Len, why do we need to build the Beis HaMikdash? What's the answer?
A place for the Shekhinah
to rest. Bruce, do you agree?
Is that the reason why?
Yeah. The Shekhinah needs a place to rest?
It's a kapara for the
Eagle. But what is the overall purpose, though? I mean, you could do a lot of things. What?
Something that for the B'nai Israel is the intangible place.
Aha. Uh-huh. Okay, so actually you said different things here. Len said it's for HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and Mr. Simon, whose first name is, again, Yoshua. Yoshua Simon says, no, it's for B'nai Israel. So Soloveitchik says that...
I didn't really mean it was for...
Ah, okay, good. So Len is already backtracking. And good. It's okay that you're backtracking, because that is the idea. That HaKadosh Baruch Hu does not need a place. HaKadosh Baruch Hu had a place. He had the whole world. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu was then mitzamtzem himself. Hashem minimized himself, so to speak, in order to allow room for the world to create. So God doesn't necessarily need us to build a Mishkan for him to have a place in this world. Rather, it's we that need HaKadosh Baruch Hu to be in the place. And therefore, we build the Mishkan in order to have a makom of Shekhinah, in order for a place for the Mishkan to be. So why do we want that? So he has a nice little hashkafic piece here where he says that man is homeless. A man does not have a home. No matter how big, large, and fortified his home is, a man is ultimately exposed. What is the only place where a man is not exposed? If a man wraps himself in a Kadosh Baruch Hu, a man is an Eved Hashem, a man is working, functioning within the context of a relationship with a Kadosh Baruch Hu, so that's when a person is not vulnerable. Because that you can never actually take away from the person. You can't force him to, nobody can ever force a person to lose his connection with a Kadosh Baruch Hu. So therefore, because the idea of the Mishkan is to represent the idea of man having a home, of man wanting HaKadosh Baruch Hu to have a place in this world, so you can't force man to buy in. Right? Man has to be able, the person has to be willing to give the money on their own. You can't force them to. Now that whole thing is a bit of a problematic. This is all really homiletic, because when we force a person, we're not actually forcing them. We force them kofinoso ad sheomer rotzani. We force them until they say I want it. Because the assumption is they really want it anyway. So the whole thing is working on a homiletic level. But that is what that is what I said. We will not have a Beis HaMikdash unless the man wants the Beis HaMikdash. And that actually explains an interesting concept that the Gemara itself discusses, but based on the pasuk in Yecheskel, where it says "Uvoba pritzim v'chiluha," that the non-Jews, the pritzim, those that were destroying the Beis HaMikdash, they came in and they were mechalel the Beis HaMikdash. Now, how could that be? So the Meshech Chachma, how could they be mechalel the Beis HaMikdash? So the Meshech Chachma explains the only way they could be mechalel the Beis HaMikdash means the Beis HaMikdash is holy, the Beis HaMikdash is kadosh. So why can a non-Jew come in and declare it not holy? So the only way that that works, says the Meshech Chachma, is if the Kedusha had already been removed prior to the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash. And that's what took place, that Bnei Yisrael themselves, who have Bailus, who have the ownership over the Beis HaMikdash, by them doing the Chatayim, by them doing the sins that brought about the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash, they were the ones who actually removed the Kedusha from the Beis HaMikdash. So when the non-Jews came in, they were really coming into a shell. They weren't coming into the Beis HaMikdash itself. So that kind of fits into this concept. He quotes a Ramban. The Ramban appears in the book of Bamidbar, actually in the middle of the book in Parshas Korach, that the Ramban says that the Beis HaMikdash becomes binding only if the people want it to be binding. Once the people remove it, it really is a tnai. It's a condition that's made between the Kadosh Baruch Hu and Bnei Yisrael. Once Bnei Yisrael says we're out, so the Beis HaMikdash has no longer kedusha, no longer has function anymore. So that all is emanating from this idea, right? The same concept of Bnei Yisrael having to willingly give as opposed to being forced to give carries itself through the duration of history about Bnei Yisrael's relationship with the Beis HaMikdash. Okay, so that's concept number one. Concept number two, we discussed in shul a couple of weeks ago, but just to nail it down a little bit more, Rav Baruch Simon, who is a distant relative of Yehoshua Simon, apparently, at least he's trying to figure out if that's the case. So he has in his Sefer Imrei Baruch a very interesting chapter on this is Maimer Hay in Parshas Truma, about the idea of diversity, the idea of pluralism, the idea of there's Yud Beis Shvatim, 12 tribes, and each represents a different path in Avodas Hashem. So he quotes Rav Schachter from the it says he heard it, although I think it's in one of his svarim, that the idea of having 12 windows in the base in the shul, that there's a minhag that the shul has 12 windows. You've seen that before? Well, okay. Right, so we sort of have it in our shul, but there are shuls that make it, right, why is it that the idea of having 12 tribes is so manifest in Batei Knesios, is so manifest in shuls? Most shuls will have some semblance of having 12 tribes there. What?
They have the stained glass windows. You know, each tribe, each window is different.
Right. So why is it that that seems to be a motif that plays a role into many Batei Knesios? So the Rav Schachter explains that the 12 tribes don't just represent not just a thing, it also represents the idea of different ways of Avodas Hashem and different ways of tefillah. So even though people might offer different styles of tefillah, still they all should be accepted by Kadosh Baruch Hu. That's the idea of having the 12 tribes there, and we have many indications of that through our tradition. The Ramban said when we list off the 12 Nesiim, the 12 princes, I guess, at the end of Parshas Nasa, where they, with the leaning that we do on Hanukkah, where it seems to be the same thing over and over and over and over and over again. So there are some nuances between the Parshios, but the Medrash on that section, the Medrash on Parshas Nasa, is almost an entire book. There might be more Medrash on that than there are is on any other Parsha, perhaps outside of Parshas Bereishis. It's very, very, there's a lot on it. Why is there a lot on it? So the Medrash is just going through each tribe, how each one had a particular kavana as to why they were bringing what they were bringing. And that is somewhat manifests itself in the verses themselves, but even beyond that, just each one had their own designation as to why they're bringing the different things that they're bringing, even though they all ended up bringing the same thing. But yet the kavanos behind them were different. And he quotes as well here that the Sefer Emes Yaakov says the same thing, having to do with the division of the tribes in the book in Parshas Bamidbar. They divided them up. There's different Degalim, divided up into 12, divided up into the 12 tribes are divided up into 4, the 3 different sides of the Beis Hamikdash, all represented by the flag. And that flag is not just you know, it's not just a coincidence. They got together and had color war to try to figure out what should be our flag. That flag has to do with the tribes, has to do with the emotions of the tribes, has to do with the characteristics of the tribes, has to do with what makes them different from one another. So diversity within unity is a very good Jewish concept.
The Torah repeats the
Kavanos
for each tribe, even though it's exactly identical.
That's what we're talking about, the Nisim. Right, it repeats it each, but there is a different motivation behind each of them. Each one had their own Kavanah.
Diversity within unity.
Yeah, right, even though we all will say the same thing during Tefillah, but the Kavanos of each person behind the Tefillah is going to be different. But it's right, diversity within unity. So Rabbi Simon points out that there is an interesting, if we look at the beginning of this parsha, Varos Elim Madamim Varos Techashim Vatseishitim, that there were ram skins and there were tachash skins. What is the tachash? So we discussed this in Shul a couple of weeks ago. The tachash is unclear. Rabbi, I believe this is the first chapter in Nathan Slifkin's book on sacred monsters, which when I quoted this the last time, Sam Samuels immediately went out and bought it, and I think has read a significant portion of it. But the first chapter of it discusses what is this tachash. It's unclear. There are some suggestions that tachash is a unicorn. Is there a unicorn in Jewish lore or not? Whatever. So that all has to do with the tachash. But Rashi just comments that the tachash was something that existed for the purpose of the Beis Hamikdash, the Mishkan, and that was it. It didn't exist anymore. So the skin that was used to cover the Mishkan was made of both ram skin as well as tachash skin. So the Meshech Chachma takes a moment, steps out and says, okay, there is a machlokas in the Gemara. The Gemara in Shabbos has a dispute about when they say the two of them were mixed together, were they merged, were the two skins one on top of another, or were they merged together? So he says, if you say that they're merged together, that's machlokas in the Gemara. So he says, if you say that they're merged together, you have a bit of a problem, because it says in the pasuk, "Oros techashim milmala." That one parak later, in parak chavav, it comments that the tachash skins was actually above the other skins. But if it was made into one skin, so how can you say that one was on top of another? Right? Good kasha, Len. Right? Right. It's a good question. So the Meshech Chachma says, he says, well, yes, but even if you assume that it was one covering, he actually quotes from his father, the tachash skin was in the highest point. What does it mean that it was in the highest point? It was in the spot directly above the Aron. That it was in the highest point, meaning the most sanctified point, that's where the tachash skin. So even though it was mixed together like a leopard, that spot, at least, was covered by a tachash skin. So why should that be? So Rabbi Simon explains his pshat in the Meshech Chachma, is that when you discuss the tachash, different animals represent different natios, different feelings, different people like different animals, etc. So the one spot in the world that can't be that can't be represented by a specific type is that spot of the Aron. That spot of the Aron has to represent a a space that can't be identified with a specific type. You can't identify that specific spot. So that spot had to be covered by the animal that was only existent during that time. It doesn't represent any other tribes, doesn't represent any individual group. That had to be separate and unique from everything else, and perhaps, in that way, a combination of everything put together.
And if, to support that, commentary has said that it was a multicolored animal.
Ah, okay. So a multicolored animal, not representing one color, not representing one type of animal, not representing one type of tribe. It had to be a unique place. Same thing with Yerushalayim. And you think about that, that idea represents itself in Yerushalayim, technically covered other people, a tribe, a mixture of Binyamin and Yehuda, but yet the spot of the Beis HaMikdash, even though it was in, was not considered part of Binyamin or Yehuda. I think Rav Shecht in one of his articles comments, it's like Washington, D.C. Washington, D.C. is not one of the 50 states. It's a separate from the 50 states, and all 50 states all equally neglected, I think.
When a person walked into the Beis HaMikdash, could you feel Hashem's presence, like more so than outside of it?
I don't think so. Do you feel Hashem's presence when you go to the Kotel today? Do you feel Hashem's presence when you go to Eretz Yisrael?
Yes.
So when you land in Israel, so if you attempt to feel it, so then it's there. So I think the same. If you look, I think that our understanding with the Beis HaMikdash is that it was unavoidable. That if you were to go and you were to see Karbanos being brought, and you were to see the Levim singing songs, so it was unavoidable to gain gain spiritual inspiration. But it doesn't mean that. I don't know if that means that the air was different. And the air was different, but it wasn't physically different. It was just it was because of the atmosphere that made it different. That's my impression. Okay, so. So that idea is also representative, perhaps, in the Aron itself. That the Aron itself, the very center of spirituality, focused on the Aron. And what is the center of the Aron? So the center of the Aron is actually empty space. Right? You have the Kruvim on the two in the middle of the Aron, but the middle of the Aron is the spot where the two Kruvim are facing each other. Because there is no object, there's nothing that can really represent the middle, that could actually represent the unity of a Kadosh Baruch Hu. It kind of, you have to just leave space and have a image of what the unity of a Kadosh Baruch Hu would actually be. And that should be enough for that. So concept number three over the course of this parsha. And this is a
empty space is unlimited. By definition, that have something that's constructed is limiting.
Exactly right. If anything would be constructed there, that would be limiting. That would be limiting in Kadosh Baruch Hu.
Right.
Yeah. Is infinite. The emptiness is really infinite. There you go. That's a good tagline. Okay, so a third concept is, if I were to ask you, there's three boxes that make up the Aron. There is the gold outside, the gold inside, and the wood in the middle. So why is there a gold outside? Well, all of them is really because Hashem said so. But the gold outside is obvious, right? We want the gold to be gold. What about the gold? Why do we need to have a gold inside? So the gold inside is a little less obvious, because no one's ever going to see the inside. But yet we make it gold on the inside anyway. So why is that? So that is a concept called Tocho Kevaro. The inside, or literally, the inside is like the outside, even though literally the outside. So what is that concept? So it's generally understood to be a concept of being consistent, that a person who... A person should be integrated, right? A person shouldn't try to demonstrate themselves being one way, but really, internally, they're really a different way. So this concept is invoked in the Gemara and Brachos. Gemara and Brachos, Daf Chav Ches Amud Aleph, tells the story of Rav Elazar ben Azari. Rav Elazar ben Azari is going to be a featured member at our Seder in a couple of weeks. Rav Elazar ben Azaria is the Harei Ani Kiven Shivim Shana. I'm like 70 years old, right? That Rav Elazar ben Azaria. So this is that story. When he turned 70, even though he was really only 18, because he was elected to be the Nasi. He was replacing Rabbi Gamliel, who had picked a bunch of fights with Rabbi Yeshua. So Rabbi Gamliel is out. They put Rabbi Elazar ben Azaria in. Rabbi Elazar ben Azaria says, the first thing he says is,
too young.
I need to ask my wife. That's actually the first thing he says. And then, and she says to him, but they're probably going to remove you, right? Being Nasi of B'nai Yisrael is like being coach of the New York Jets, right? You ain't going to last very long. Eventually, they're going to have to fire you. So he says to her, Lishtamish inish yom achad v'chasid demokra, let a person use a glass cup one day, and the next day he'll break it. I mean, good to have this zuchus one day, even though you're going to end up losing it. So Amrle, she says to him, Leislach chivarasa, but you have no white hairs. Hayu yom abar tamnei sari shaniyav. That day he was 18, a miracle happened, and he had 18 rows of hair in his beard that all turned white. So that overnight he turned white, and that's why he looked 70, but was really 18 years old. Fine. So that's why he says, so they tell the story, the Gemara, the first thing that then happens the next day. Tana Osayom, this is in Brachos Daf Chavcha Samad Aleph. Osayom Silkuhu L'Shomer HaPesach. That day they took away the guy who was watching the entry to yeshiva, the security guard in front of the yeshiva. They removed him. Why? V'nitna lehem reshuso tamidim lichanis. And they gave permission for all students to enter. So they removed the entry requirement. Whoever wanted to come to yeshiva, that they could come in. Shehayer Rav Gamliel Machers of Omer, because Rav Gamliel said, Kol tamet she'ein tochul kevaro, lo yichanis levesa medrash. Anybody who is not inside matching his outside, lo yichanis, he should not enter into the base medrash. So Ahu Yom, the Gemara says, Atosu Kamasasa, they had many benches, Amar Rabbi Yochanan, Pligiba Rabbi Yosef, and the sons of Rabbanan, they argue about it. One says it was 400, one says it was 700, and Rabbi Gamliel was Chalsha Daite, he was dispirited. Amar, he said, maybe I held back Torah from the Jewish people because of my high entry requirement. So they showed him in his dream white pitchers filled with ash. What does that mean? That the pitchers might be white on the outside, they're worthless ash on the inside. I mean, you don't have to worry about it, but yet nevertheless, the assumption is that Rav Gamliel was considered to be wrong and everyone else was considered right, and they were just showing him that in order for him to feel better. I think that's our assumption about it. But anyways.
Did he last long?
What?
How long did he stay there?
I believe Rabbi Gamliel came back ultimately, and they were co-Nasim for a while, for many years. That's why, if you, in the Haggadah, when it talks about the five Chachamim that were in Bnei Brak, so Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah, I believe, is listed third.
Haggadah here.
You can look it up. I believe Rav Elazar ben Azariah is listed third. Why is he listed third? Even though he's... So the third is because when you have... That means that he was in the middle. If you had the five people at the front, that means he was in the middle at the head of the table. Even though the other Rabbanim there were his senior. You can look that up. Not positive, I think that that's the case there.
Isn't that a pretty superficial interpretation of that concept, though? That his beard turned around? That's not what we're talking about, really. That one's action should be...
Oh, I'm not focused on his beard turning white. I'm more focused on this entry requirement that Rav Gamliel had that Rav Elazar ben Azariah removed. Rav Gamliel had this entry this requirement of Tochu Kabaro, that you have to be consistent. And Rav Yehuda Elazar ben Azariah, for some reason, felt the need to remove that entry requirement. So let's notice Rabbi Aryeh Steckler, who now is running a yeshiva in the high school in Teaneck, pointed out that Tochu Kevaro, if you think about what the words actually mean, it's a little backwards. Well, how would I want to translate consistency, right? That the outside should match your inside, right? Your inside is X, and your outside should match your inside. The words don't actually mean it. Tochu Kevaro means your inside should match your outside, right? It's a flipped concept. So what does it mean your inside should match your outside? So perhaps the idea is that when you're coming into yeshiva, you learn a lot of things, and you're taught a lot of things. So tochu kevaro, you should be ready to allow your inside to match your outside. You should allow that as I learn things, as I continue to learn, and I consider to develop, and I consider to gain more concepts, I should allow it that I, rather than having all those things meet what I learned, what I already know, I should have my inside match that which I am learning. I should be open to the fact that I haven't actually learned yet. So those are the Talmidim that Rabbi Gamliel wanted. Rabbi Gamliel wanted it that if you're going to come into my yeshiva, you better be willing to change. So why did Rav Elazar ben Azariah remove that requirement? That sounds like, now we understand the concept a little more. That sounds like a pretty good idea, right? You're coming to my yeshiva, you're going to learn something, you better be willing to change the way you act in order to match what you learn. So why did Rav Elazar ben Azariah remove that requirement? So I'd suggest that Rav Gamliel was saying, I want you to buy in before you come into yeshiva. Listen, you're coming in here, these are the rules. Perhaps Rav Elazar ben Azariah was willing to say, you don't have to buy in. Come and learn. If you come and learn, you're going to change. Rather than making it a demand up front, Rav Elazar ben Azariah was willing to have the emunah in the Torah, the faith in the Torah, that you're going to want a desire to change. That I don't need to make it a requirement, because that's ultimately something that's going to happen on his own. And that's what you're going to get. Tilchu Kavaru, the inside will match the outside. The things that you learn, the way that you develop, will ultimately have an impact on your inner neshama, your inner soul, your inner actions, your inner thoughts, your inner emotions. You'll be able to continue to grow and develop as a Ben Torah. So that's it. Wonderful Zman. This is the last day of Shir. Right, to conclude the Zman, we'll pick up Mirs Hashem following Pesach. Thank you for driving me, for pushing me to prepare. Thank you, Bruce, for all your criticism. And we'll and Mirs Hashem will continue on in the Book of Shmos following Pesach.